1 Corinthians chapter 10, if you would. In your New Testaments, 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and we'll begin reading with verse 11. Hope you can come back for Dusty's preaching this evening. And guys, hope you can come for our business meeting. We need your help, as always. Paul says to the Corinthian church, "Now all these things happened unto them for examples," is the King James word. "And they're written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. There is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make up a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it." God's always helping. He's always watching out for us. And those circumstances of life that often seem to be overwhelming, He is a very present help in time of trouble. And for that we are thankful. And Paul's challenge to the Corinthian church is the same as God's challenge to us this morning. That is simply to hang in there with God. In the midst of all of the trials, the temptations, and the testing that come as we live our life between the cradle and the grave, don't ever give up on God. You see, the problem that he's addressing in the first portion of 1 Corinthians 10 was the problem of God's people way back yonder. And they did give up on God. And they shouldn't have. I mean, they didn't understand the circumstances of everything surrounding Sinai and the deliverance and all those things that were going on. I mean, those were overwhelming circumstances. But they had these great blessings that God gave in their deliverance and their freedom. But when they came to the river to cross over in the promised land, they had this tremendous opportunity to go right in there and to take by faith what God had already promised. But they didn't. Instead, they just turned away in unbelief, and so began the struggle with the people of God, who, as he says in the first portion of that chapter, after all they had seen and after all they had heard at Sinai, after all they experienced personally with God, and knew to be true, they turned to idolatry. They committed fornication. They murmured against God. They were guilty of submitting to their lust. I mean, that's just in those few verses that are before us. You would have thought that Satan would never have gained access to their heart. But in one day, 23,000 died. I believe that'd make the morning papers, wouldn't it? Died because of their sin. Died because of their testing God, their unwillingness to believe God. And he said, these things stand as examples, verse 11, to all of us. I mean, the end of the world is eventually coming. We've been told that. Let's live ready. Let's not give up on God. There's not any temptation that's taken you, but such as is common to man, regardless of how often we want to convince ourselves that we are a special case, and that what we are called upon to face in life as we are challenged by life's circumstances is above and beyond that which most men have to endure. And we just sometimes get to feeling like we're picked on a little and ought not to be picked on. Never forget that God is faithful. Never forget that whatever it is that you're called upon to bear, and some of you are bearing a big load right now. I know you are. But never forget that God won't allow it to be greater than what He gives you the strength by which to bear that load. And that with every temptation that comes, God is faithful. And that with the temptation, something else always comes. And that thing that always comes is a way to escape that, so that we can bear what is before us. We're thinking this morning about that little phrase in verse 13. It says there are things that are common to men. As much as we are not alike, we are an awful lot alike. And not just here as being a citizens in a very blessed and great country, but we have a lot in common with those that have never been to America, who have never sat down before a computer, who've never used a cell phone, who wear clothes that don't look anything like the clothes that we wear, who live in an environment and a climate that is unlike anything that we live in. There are cultures and societies of people scattered across Africa and South America and Asia That just by looking on the surface of things, you think, well, we don't have much in common with those folks. But we do. We have a lot in common. We're interested in beauty here in America. And that's fine. We like beautiful people. You don't find a culture or society anywhere, regardless of how primitive it is, it's not interested in beauty. And so they do things in order to try and bring out their natural beauty or to enhance their beauty. And some of the stuff they do is weird, and some of the stuff we do to them is weird, and it's unthinkable that you would confuse that with beauty of any kind. And so among those cultures that think bigger lips are beautiful, you know, National Geographic used to carry those features and still do some, you know, and as they look at those primitive cultures and how they seek to enhance their lips to make them much larger than what they normally would be. And so they go in and they slit, you know, inside the bottom of the lip and inside the top of the lip. And they slit it over and over and over again among their ladies. So that as the scar tissue forms, you know, the lips just keep on pushing out. And part of the bride's dowry is enhanced because of the size of those lips. We wouldn't think that something like that would enhance our beauty in America, would we? No. I mean, we don't slit the inside of our lips. We just take a needle and stuff and shoot them full of stuff and make them pooch out and look all weird and that kind of stuff so that the next time we see that actress on TV, we say, what happened to her? What was she thinking? We just shove needles into our skin, you know, and we get worried about, we quit talking about wrinkles. I mean, that's not in to talk about wrinkles. We talk about age lines. And so we shove those needles in, we put in that gel stuff, and we pooch those wrinkles out and get rid of every wrinkle on our face, and our face is frozen for eternity. It does not move. We call that beauty, or at least some among us do. Now, we have different ideas of what constitutes beauty, but we all believe in beauty. We all respect beauty. We have different ideas as to what constitutes education. You know, we don't have much in common with those folks over there that don't have electricity and that never use electronics. And we look down upon them for their ignorance and think we need to take everything that we've got, or at least as much as we can, and shove it over to them so that their life will be improved. And those folks living in those cultures say, take it back. What are you giving us? And they look down upon us for our ignorance. I mean, the white guys that go over among their aborigines and try and teach them some things, look down. They have language. They have terms in their language that describes us, white people. They go over to help them because they're so ignorant. And the basic term that describes us most often is stupid. Well, we are. I mean, from their standpoint as to what gauges education and ignorance, and we're the most ignorant people they've ever seen. We'd starve to death out there in 3 days. Wouldn't have a clue about where to go for food or how to find water. For all our differences, though, we have a lot in common. What makes us happy makes them happy, and what makes us sad makes them sad. And what we all experience anger, and we experience discouragement and disillusionment, and all of us get grouchy from time to time. All of us fall ill. And eventually all of us die. We have many things in common. And I just remind us of that this morning, lest Luke chapter 18 and the story that Jesus told there become our story. And we've read this passage many times, but Jesus told this story purposely about the Pharisee who went up to the temple to pray and about another one that went up to the temple to pray. And the Pharisee stood, verse 11, and prayed this. Here was his prayer. So if you're thinking about how you should pray before God, understand, don't ever pray like this. Don't ever pray like this. And his prayer was this. God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers. Even as this publican, I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. So that was his prayer. And he thanked God that he wasn't like that other guy, that he didn't have anything in common with that other guy. And as we look upon other people, those that we encounter day by day, and see that their circumstances are vastly different than ours, let's be careful, lest we think we have nothing in common with the trash that surrounds us. We have lots and lots of things in common. So I'll cite three or four this morning, and then I'll get out. We share a common worth. Every one of us. We share a common worth. What constitutes or forms the basis of that worth? You say, well, Larry, if you look at my portfolio and if you judge the size of my home and the amount that it would bring if I were to sell that, and look at my vehicles that I could serve and check my savings account and all those kinds of things and put a dollar figure on all of that, then that testifies, it substantiates my value. It doesn't have anything to do with your value or mine. Our worth is determined by three different things. It's determined by the image that I bear. It is determined by the potential that we all share. And it is determined by the extent of His care. And you can't put a dollar figure on any of that. Genesis 1:26, way back in the beginning, we know that the Lord said, let us make man in our own image. And so in the image of God created He him. Male and female created He them. And so here we are, bearing that image today, all these thousands of years later. Every single one of us bearing the image of God. In this building, across this county, through this state, beyond this nation, and into the world. All of us bearing the image of God. It constitutes our value. It substantiates our worth. Who's worth the most? If we were to take the 10 youngest kids that we got here in the assembly this morning and kind of put them up here, some of them have to be sitting in their basket, but put them up here in front of us, the 10 youngest kids, and say, and let you pick. Let's take a vote and see which one of these children are the most precious or the most valuable. Let's take the top seven of those people, and if there's 12 of them here or 10 of them here, let's discount the last three. Whoever's on the three, let's set them aside. I mean, they're not as much value as the other seven or five or two. You know, to even have a discussion like that is unthinkable, isn't it? To even begin to imply that there's some way that we could take a precious child and another precious child and say this one is greater than that, this one is better, this one is more worthy. We share a common worth. And yet we do that in America constantly. It just saddens all of us and it breaks our heart. I mean, we wouldn't take one of these 10 kids up here and say, let's take the three that are not as worthy as the others and let's go ahead and put them to death. You know, relieve their misery. They're not as worth as much, and so they're going to have a hard time. It's unthinkable that we abort babies by the tens of thousands every year. Because we judge, you see, we say that there's not as much worth in this one as there is in that one. And so we do what we do, and we are so ashamed. Or maybe we're not. But we ought to be. The image that we bear, it's part of the evidence of the worth that we have. Paul was at Antioch preaching in a synagogue. And he said concerning the Jewish people in that synagogue, because they weren't listening to the gospel, he said in Acts 13, verse 46, seeing as how you judge yourselves unworthy of everlasting life, we turn to the Gentiles. God wants us all saved. You see, His invitation to humanity is, whosoever will, let him come and take of the water of life freely. His invitation is, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, in Matthew 11, and I'll give you rest. His invitation is to every single one of us. Because according to Jesus in John 3:16, we are loved of God. And as a matter of fact, He loved us so much, Jesus said that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. We have a common worth because we bear a common image. We have a common worth because of the potential we share. Not everybody measures up to the potential. As a matter of fact, probably none of us do. But we are all created with potential. Some of us use our potential to do all kinds of mean, rascally, not nice things. Others of us use our potential to try and do what's right. To try and be decent people that would even be judged in society as decent people. We have potential. When Saul was not king, when Saul was just a guy, a big guy, but a guy, God chose him because Israel was demanding to have a king like the other nations around them. And so God chose Saul and said, he's our man. And He sent Samuel down to anoint Saul. And Samuel went down to anoint Saul, and he was out plowing in the field. And that was it. And so He anointed him to be king, and later on set the date by which when they would have a coronation, you know, put the crown on his head and the nation would all applaud. And when that time came, Samuel came to crown him as the king of Israel, and they couldn't find him. So they had to call out a search party. and they found him hiding back behind some baggage because he didn't feel worthy to lead this people. God saw potential in a man that didn't feel worthy. Now, Saul changed over the course of time, unfortunately. But God saw the potential in Saul. And so many of David, you know, the youngest son of Jesse and Joseph. Daniel. Elisha. When Elijah came to call Elisha, he was standing knee-deep in mud behind two oxen. But he became one of the greatest prophets of God that ever lived. So the potential that we share, Ephesians 5:14, Paul said to the Ephesian church, "Awake thou that sleepest and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light." We tend to pass our lives in a dull stupor. One of the purposes we have in coming together as a church is to wake each other up. To let you know that God is active in this church. And when we say He's active in this church, He can't be active in this church unless He's active in you. And through you, He has plans to accomplish great things. If you will be faithful, it's almost a guarantee you'll take somebody to heaven with you. And if you won't be, I can guarantee you this, you'll take more than one somebody with you, but not to heaven. Because we all have within us that potential. It argues our worth. The extent of His care argues our worth. God really does care. We ask ourselves in the song, "Does Jesus care?" And we answer in the song, "Yes, He cares." Because He really does. Now, sometimes it is far easier to not acknowledge or admit the fact that He cares than it is to accept that. It's easier to say, "Well, nobody cares about my circumstance." And it may be true in the human sense that nobody knows and nobody cares, but it's not true of God. But it's sometimes easier just to whine around about things than it is to accept the reality of His care. Because once you accept that, it changes how you see things, how you view your circumstances. Those things argue our worth. So there is the commonality of our worth. There is the commonality of our problem that's spoken of in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It's common temptation that we share. And the yielding to that temptation, which constitutes sin in the sight of God, becomes the common problem that all of us have. With no exceptions. The problems of the elders in this church are the same problems you've got. They're not any different. The problems our deacons face, our teachers face, we share the same kinds of problems. Discouragement comes. We become disillusioned. We wonder about our faith and why it's so weak and shallow sometimes. Our seeming inability or unwillingness to trust. We all struggle with those same kinds of issues because sin is a reality. The potential for that sin is always there before us. What shall we say then? What advantage hath the Jew in Romans chapter 3 verse 1? Or what profit is there of circumcision? And he said there's a whole lot. But bear this in mind. Are we Jews, verse 9 of Romans 3, better than those, the Gentiles? And he says, no, in no wise, for we before proved both Jew and Gentile that they're all under sin. There's none righteous. No, there's not one righteous. And understand about sin what you already know. We've all dealt with it enough to know. It has a voracious appetite. We hunger. Either for righteousness or we hunger for sin. But we will hunger, folks, because we've been created hungry. And if we're not giving ourselves to what is right, then we will hunger for what is wrong and we'll never get enough. It'll never be enough. So that the voracious appetite of sin will consume us ultimately. It always takes more and more and more of what we at one time thought was enough. It's never enough. You remember the story in Daniel chapter 5? If not, let me remind you of it very quickly. The guy on the throne is named Belshazzar. He has succeeded ultimately his grandfather. I know in the King James it says his father, but it is his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. And Belshazzar, his grandson, is now on the throne. And he's having this party in Daniel chapter 5 for 1,000 of his lords. Big building, 1,000 of his lords. And in addition to those that were there, the princes, all of his wives and all of his concubines, all of them there drinking. And so they drank wine, verse 4, and they praised the gods of gold and silver and brass and iron and wood and stone. And they were drinking out of the vessels that had been taken from the temple by Nebuchadnezzar back when Jerusalem had been overrun. Nebuchadnezzar had enough good sense to stick those off in a storage room and leave them there, and they had not been out for two generations. But Belshazzar thought it would be a funny thing, because sin is funny, to simply use those and to toast their gods and to mock the Jews one more time. And at the time that he did that, verse 5, we usually call it a hand, but it really wasn't the whole hand, was it? It was the fingers of a hand that came out and rolled over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. Not everybody saw the writing. I mean, there's a big room and you can't all see everything, but the king saw it, and the fingers of that hand wrote some words. And the king was scared to death. He brought in his wise folks and said, "What does that mean? I mean, what is that?" Four words were written on the walls of his palace. And they didn't know. I mean, it was language that they had never studied or learned. And they didn't know what those four words meant. And so he was growing more and more trouble. The queen told him, "There's a guy. If you remembered your granddad Nebuchadnezzar, you would remember this guy because he served under him and he was wiser than anybody else. And he could interpret dreams and tell folks all kinds of things. You need to send for him." And so Daniel was sent for. Nebuchadnezzar told him what he told the other wise men. "If you'll interpret this for me, you'll have piles of money. You can just see the piles of money coming in. I'll make you a ruler of the third part of my kingdom." And so he told Daniel the same thing in verse 16. And Daniel said, "Don't want your money. Don't want anything of you." But he said, "I'll tell you what these words mean." And the words are found in verse 25 of Daniel chapter 5. But first, Daniel says, you should have learned from your granddad, because God worked with him and he had to eat grass in the wilderness just like an ox until he learned that there was one God in heaven. And he learned that and said, "You haven't learned that, have you? You should have listened." Here were the words, Mene, reported twice, really three words, but Tekel Upharsin. And they were not Babylonian words. These were Aramaic words, not even Hebrew words. Aramaic, written on the wall. And basically what God is telling is this. First word, your time is done. Second word, Tekel, your opportunity is over. Third word, Perez. You say, "I thought it was Upharsin." Well, Perez is singular, Upharsin is plural, same word, but you've lost it all. Lost it all. And he did, because of the sin that he brought in and his determination that he wouldn't let go of that sin and learn what he ought to learn in life. We all lose when we play sin's game. I mean, there just is no winning out over that. And regardless of how much we want to blame somebody else and assume that it is their fault, this mess that I am in, it's your fault, so you get me out of it. It doesn't work that way. I know others tempt us, and I know others fail us, and I know all of those things are true. But what you do, you do. And the choices you make, and I make, are the choices that you and I make. And we are accountable for all of those kinds of things. You see, it's my stubbornness. It's not the fault of my parents. It's not the fault of this church. It's my stubbornness. It's my rebellion. It's your ignorance. It's your pride. It's your presumption. It's your ingratitude. It's your fault. This business of sin. There's not anybody to blame. Well, the temptation was too great. No, it wasn't too great. You yielded. I yielded. But it wasn't too great. It's common to what everyone else experiences. And if one man in all of human society can overcome that temptation, then every man can overcome that temptation. We are accountable. We share that common problem of sin. We share, thirdly, the common solution to sin, which of course is Jesus. It's not by just trying harder or determining that I'm going to do better. It is by uttering the absolute confession of the faith that we are unworthy. And we are totally dependent upon the sacrifice that Jesus made upon that cross. I have no other hope other than Calvary. Absolutely none. Well, you're a preacher of the gospel. Yeah, but that's not my hope. You're an elder in the church. Yeah, but that's not my hope. My hope is in Jesus Christ, because He is the only solution that any of us have for the problem of sin. It comes with such commonality into our lives. When we finally come to understand that the blame for my sin is entirely mine, and the guilt that comes with that blame is entirely mine, then maybe we'll understand that we need to ask the question that we haven't yet asked, that they did ask in Acts 2 when they said to Peter and the apostles, "Men and brethren, what shall we do?" That the eunuch did ask in Acts chapter 8 to Stephen when he said, "See, here is water. What doth hinder me to be baptized?" When we come to understand our desperation, our accountability, we'll ask the question. You say, "Larry, is it as simple as that?" It is as simple as that. It's business of salvation. If God wanted to make it complicated, He'd have made it so complicated none of us could figure it out. But He wanted to make it very plain, very self-evident. You just have to come. We share a common destination, lastly. Hebrews 9:27, "It's appointed unto man once to die, and after this there is the judgment." So there is that appointment with death that we have, and then immediately following that death, or at some point in time, whatever the interval in, there is judgment, and we shall all stand before the judgment seat, Romans 14, of the Lord Jesus Christ. We share a common end. And we're all at a good dying age. I've told you that before. Doesn't matter how old you are. You say, "Larry, I've got too much to do." No, you don't. Doesn't matter how much money you owe. "I've got 30 mortgage payments left on my house." Well, you're going to have to take those down in the grave with you. None of us know when. The very healthiest of us here in the building this morning have a very flimsy grip on life, and it will easily slip. It doesn't take much. So we need to be prepared. I look through my book from time to time of funerals that I've conducted and of the ages of people and all of that. And for every name that is there and the date the funeral was held, I see a face and I remember. Most of those were Christians. Some of them were not. And that's tragic, because it didn't have to be. Because every one of those that were of age accountable had opportunity and knew of the commonality of the problem of sin. I mean, how can you live in America and not know it? And knew of the commonality of the solution. How can you live in America and not know that the answer to that is Jesus? But never embraced the answer. Life is that which is, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. It is by and large that which is common to man. I invite you this morning to accept the common solution to the common problem that we share. And that is to come in confession of your faith and repentance of sin and in baptism into Christ for the remission of all of those sins, that He might add you to the church. And that you and I together then, Ephesians 3 verse 21, might live to the glory of God in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all ages, world without end. What an opportunity you have today. Or if you need our prayers as God's child, the opportunity stands. We'll sing the first and last stanza, "You Come Home, We Stand and Sing."